Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the programme every week here on Premier Christian Radio that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. We create conversations that matter, and I do hope you enjoy what we've got lined up for you today. It's a classic atheist versus Christian, was Jesus a myth kind of debate. So we're going to be introducing my two guests in a moment's time for what I think is going to be a very spirited encounter between them. Just time to mention before we launch into today's discussion that after Unbelievable, you can hear the profile. Sam Hales is speaking to Barack Obama's former faith advisor, Michael Weir. That should be a really interesting conversation, especially obviously with the inauguration over this weekend of his successor, Donald Trump. Also, some very good news for those who have been and want to come again to Unbelievable, the conference 2017. The ticketing will be opening this coming week. So premier.org.uk/whychrist. That's the website to go to if you want to look out for that. Hoping for that to be open from about Tuesday onward this week. Unbelievable Conference 2017 is going to be themed Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe and everything. And some brilliant guests joining us for that. Professor John Lennox returns after, I think, 4 or 5 year hiatus from being with us at Unbelievable the Conference, but thoroughly looking forward to having John with us again. Andy Bannister will be there from the Solar Center for Public Christianity, Beth Grove on Islam again, and a variety of other guests, including guests brought over with our conference partner again, the Christian Thinkers Society. Jeremiah J. Johnston will be joining us, and many more besides. And I hope you can be there too, and I'll be delighted to share more details about the conference in coming weeks. I will be actually speaking myself at the conference as well, because I'll be launching my new book as well. So Saturday the 13th of May, that's the date to put in your diary, and do check out the website when ticketing opens this coming week, premier.org.uk/whychrist. Okay, time to get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, was Jesus a myth based on other legendary religious figures of his world? David Marshall is a Christian thinker and author, and his latest book, Jesus Was No Myth, The Fingerprints of God on the Gospels, takes aim squarely at people like Richard Carrier, Bart Ehrman and Reza Aslan, scholars who claim that myths and legends borrowed from other religious figures surrounding Jesus obscured the historical core of Jesus. Historian Richard Carrier goes quite far, actually, and he says that Jesus never actually existed. Now, he's been on the programme a few years back making that case. At the time, he hadn't written the book that has since come out on the historicity of Jesus, why we may have reason to doubt. But we'll find out from him today why he believes that on the show and what response David Marshall has for him in turn. I'll make sure there are ways you can access their books from links to today's show as well. And a very warm welcome to you both, Richard and David. Welcome along to the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you both. Thanks for joining me. We'll start with you, first of all, David. You're the one who got in touch about this book. It's just been released, and it sounds really interesting. I know it's had some glowing reviews from people like Craig Blomberg says David Marshall presents a rare combination of forms of expertise, historical Jesus research and a knowledge of ancient Mediterranean and Asian religions, to demonstrate how distant the alleged parallels between the New Testament Gospels' portrait of Jesus and other religious figures of his world are. So you've been on the show a number of times before, David. What got you particularly interested in writing about these attempts to, as it were, see Jesus as sort of, and you know, having these various commonalities with other religious figures of the ancient world?
About 10 years ago, I wrote a book taking issue with the Jesus Seminar, which was a group of liberal scholars in the United States mostly, who came together and debated which parts of the Gospels were reliable and credible and which parts were not. And to do that, I analyzed the Gospels, and I discovered that they had 50 characteristics that they shared in common, which defined them as literary works. And when I looked at some of the parallels that the Jesus Seminar put forward, just to say that they saw as similar to the Gospels, I found that they did not share these characteristics at all, and that often scholars of the Jesus Seminar ilk were not recognizing what was in fact before their eyes when they were opening the Gospels and not seeing these very important characteristics that define the Gospels. Of those 50 characteristics, I found that 50 of them, or 25 of them, about half of them, had to do with the historicity of the Gospels, and I believe strongly support the historicity of the Gospels. And so for this book, what I did was I took those 25 characteristics and then five more characteristics which other scholars have found in the Gospels that support their historicity, and I argue that these are the fingerprints of God on the Gospels, that they show that the Gospels are, in fact, credible. Now, there have been a lot of scholars like N.T. Wright and Craig Blomberg and Richard Baucom who have argued for the general historicity of the Gospels, and I appreciate their work, but I think Jesus Is No Myth goes a couple steps further by finding a whole panoply of traits within the Gospels themselves which demonstrate their historicity pretty much beyond doubt. Not every single word, of course, but in a general sense.
Could you maybe give us just an idea of one or two of those? I know you can't, it's a big book and you can't sketch them all out, but one or two ideas of how you've seen that kind of verification of the historicity of Jesus in the Gospels.
Well, some of them are pretty basic, like how close in time the Gospels are to the events they record, whether they even claim to be historical, how the Gospels describe Jesus in a cultural sense, how they define Jesus culturally, and whether or not that's a credible picture, whether or not Jesus offers surprising non-platitudinous teachings, which, as G.K. Chesterton points out, is very, very rare among even great moral teachers in the ancient world, to be consistently creative and unique in how he teaches moral values. Well, let me put it this way. I'm a teacher, and as a teacher, I find that some of my students really stand out in the classroom, and they speak up while other students are kind of go along with the flow, and they kind of listen to what their fellow students are doing. Well, the Gospels are like that too. The personalities of a few of Jesus' followers really stand out, like Peter and Thomas to a lesser extent, and of course Judas and Mary Magdalene. This is something you wouldn't expect from a non-historical writing about the Gospels, but it's something that you do find in historical works, like, for example, the Analects of Confucius and things like that, where you have an actual teacher who's actually in the classroom or out in the Galilean countryside teaching his students, and a few of them really stand out. Another characteristic, to give another example, is the originality and depth and cultural transcendence of Jesus' teachings. Some of the characteristics are social. Some of them have to do with Jesus as a teacher or the theology of the Gospels. And then some of them have to do with traits like, for example, the criteria of embarrassment, which Richard Carrier takes issue in one of his books. Multiple attestation, what Timothy and Lydia McGrew call undesigned coincidence. And I believe you've talked to Timothy about this before in a debate with
Bart Ehrman.
With Bart Ehrman, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And, of course, N.T. Wright's criteria of what he calls double similarity, double dissimilarity, which he does a very thorough job of describing in some of his very long books on the historical Gospels.
So, I mean, there's a few people, David, that you kind of, if you like, pick a fight with in this book? Richard Carrier being one of them, and we'll obviously be hearing him in a moment. But also Bart Ehrman and Reza Aslan. Now, they don't say Jesus didn't exist, but they obviously do say, in Reza Aslan's case, he was a political zealot. In Bart Ehrman's case, that what we have in the Gospels is a severely overlaid version of whatever this Jewish preacher was, and so on. Is it your contention that they're all doing essentially the same thing as Richard, saying we don't really have the Jesus of history in the Jesus of the Gospels, and you want to kind of take issue with that?
Well, you could say I'm picking a fight with them, but there's another way of looking at it, and that is, I believe that Richard Kerr is actually doing Christians a service, and so are these other fellows. They are scouring the ancient world for parallels to Jesus into the Gospels, and they're putting forward the best parallels that they can find to try to explain, fill the gap in the universe between Jesus and all other ancient teachers, and all modern teachers for that matter. And so the parallels that they come up with, I think, are very interesting, and they're very worth analyzing, but not according to a willy-nilly ad hoc sort of criteria that you open up the books next to each other and you see what's there and you see what sticks out and this kind of confirmation bias problem there. But by according to a preset criteria, you do a little more careful methodology. You begin with your criteria and then you look at the books and be very carefully and analytically determine which of those characteristics various works share.
Okay.
And that's kind of my... that's not really a beef with them so much. Yeah. Actually, I find them kind of very helpful.
And just to be clear, in terms of what you're critiquing here, a lot of people have already pointed out that those types of mythical theories involving, Jesus was just an amalgamation of Horus and Isis and kind of ancient Egyptian gods have very little evidence for them because the analogies all break down at one point or another. But you're more concerned with those who say, actually, it was these analogies are more to do with figures around him who may well have existed, but they sort of borrowed from in that way, and saying, no, in similar way, Jesus is unique and distinct from those other stories, histories, and figures.
Well, most of the works that I compare are, in fact, fictional. I look at all of the ancient xiaoshuo, think of the Chinese words that... I look at all of the ancient novels, and I look at plays. I look at the works of Homer and some of the, Euripides and some of the other playwrights, and a lot of hagiography, which can be about real historical figures. So most of them are fictional, the works that I compare to the Gospels. But also there are some works that are based kind of around Jesus. There are a lot of so-called Gnostic Gospels, which I argued in an earlier book, really are not Gospels at all, and they don't share barely any of the characteristics of the Gospels. And I also compare some works that are historical, and I find better parallels to the Gospels, such as the Analects of Confucius, which I actually think is the best parallel to the Gospels that I've found so far.
Okay, good stuff. Thank you very much for introducing the book, David. Again, the book is Jesus Was No Myth, The Fingerprints of God on the Gospels. David Marshall is our Christian guest on the show, defending the historical Jesus today and saying many people have tried to, as it were, say that other figures, historical, religious, made-up figures in Jesus' day and age have tried to make out that there are various parallels between them, and that therefore this was what the writers of the Gospels were borrowing as they created their accounts of Jesus and so on. Richard Carrier, welcome back to the programme today. Great to have you on again. You were last on not long ago debating Richard Weikart on Hitler, but now we're really on your central ground, which is the historicity of Jesus. So before we move into talking about David Marshall's book in particular, do you want to just very briefly summarise your most recent book on the historicity of Jesus and the kind of arguments you're making in that book?
Right, yeah. That book came out in 2014, published by Sheffield Phoenix Press. The general idea that I'm exploring in there, and it was something that surprised me. I was long against this idea that Jesus didn't exist. I thought it was quite obvious that he did, and it was a silly crank thing. And there's a lot of crank stuff about this on the internet, for example, and some really terrible books trying to argue this that are also definitely not worth listening to. But when I had some friends and some people whose opinions I respected insisted that I read Earl Doherty's book, The Jesus Puzzle, and review it. So I did, and then that actually surprised me because he actually did his work. He was actually much more cautious, and his theory was actually plausible. It actually fit the evidence and made me realize that there are some serious questions about the evidence. And eventually, over time, I got funding to do a research project on this specifically, and so this resulted in several books, the last of which is On the Historicity of Jesus, which encapsulates about 6 years of research on this question, trying to find out what is the best evidence for the historicity of Jesus and what is the best evidence against, and comparing the two. And so the book does both, and I give historicity the best possible chance, and then go through the evidence item by item and show that when you really look at the evidence that's presented for the historicity of Jesus, it all starts to dissolve. So certainly, like, for example, the evidence outside the Bible doesn't really hold up as something that can corroborate the Bible because it's either forged or just basically repeating what the Bible says or repeating what the New Testament says. And we don't have any independent checks on what's in the New Testament. So that leaves us with the New Testament. And that's really our only source for the historicity of Jesus. And what the New Testament gives us are a bunch of epistles, once we exclude the ones that are recognized widely by mainstream scholarship as forgeries, all we have left are certain epistles that actually never clearly put Jesus on earth. They seem to talk about Jesus in a cosmic, theological, scriptural sense, and talk about receiving the teachings of him through revelation, rather than people actually sitting at his feet and then passing on what he said. And so when you look at that, that starts to look very odd, and you have to analyze that detail to really understand aspects of this, because there's arguments pro and con that, and I have a whole chapter on that in my book. And then what else you have is just the Gospels, essentially, an act which is a riff on the, you know, base, drawing material from the Gospels and then rewriting the history of Paul from his letters. And the Gospels look wildly mythical. I mean, this is a thing where you've got, you know, the hero flies through the air with Satan and stands on a mountain to view the whole world. He's magically withering fig trees, walking on water. He's casting demons into pigs and killing 2,000 pigs as they run into a lake and drown themselves. This is the kind of story, when you look at detail and detail and detail, every single chapter of the Gospels contains something that's implausible in terms of an actual historical event or something, or an actual way someone would speak or in a way someone would act. There's a lot of unrealism. And actually, most of the mainstream scholarship on this has found that this unrealism actually serves the function of allegory, that these are symbolic narratives. The reason Jesus withers a fig tree is not because he actually withered a fig tree and someone actually watched him do it. It's that that whole story actually represents a narrative, a symbolic narrative about explaining why God allowed the Jewish temple to be destroyed. And this comes from the peer-reviewed literature, too. So when you look at the way, and that I analyze how that comes out and how R.G. Hamerton Kelly argued that in the peer-reviewed literature in my book. So when you actually look at the Gospels, they look very highly mythical, and they don't look like straightforward rational histories or biographies, rational biographies of the okay. time. And even insofar as they look like them, yeah. So but this is the case that I build lots of angles on this, and that's why the book is so long. I detail, go through every single argument.
Sure. I mean, and I'm sure David will want to respond to some of those aspects of the book. Specifically, though, regarding the interest David has in these claimed parallels between other religious, be they mythical or historical figures of his day, how far do you think that the Gospels did borrow from typical ways in which people would build their particular figure, if you like?
Right. I mean, obviously a lot of what is Jesus is built out of the Old Testament. That Jesus is made to be a new Moses, a new Elijah. Elements are taken from the book of Daniel. These ideas are brought in, and then Jesus is basically revamped as sort of the better Moses, the better Elijah, conveying the new Christian values that they wanted to convey. So there's a lot of borrowing from the Old Testament mythology. As well. But there's also elements of the story that are drawn from popular literature and from the other salvation cults of the time. Savior cults were very popular at this during this era. And it's worth pointing out, one of the things I want to point out about Marshall's book is that I didn't find it a terribly useful read for someone who really wants to seriously analyze the debate on this issue, because he doesn't deal with the peer-reviewed literature hardly at all on these issues, and doesn't deal with a lot of the evidence that I present in the book regarding what these parallels consist of and what they don't consist of. Certainly he makes a lot of valid points that, as even I have made, that there are a lot of invalid parallels that are claimed and on the internet and so on. But when you look at what's actually going on, what actually these savior cults consisted of, and where the parallels are, and you look at the savior cults amongst each other, the parallels they have with each other, they're all very different from each other. You know, Osiris cult is very different from Zalmoxis cult, is very different from Inanna cult, and so on, very different from Mitra cults. Well, and so differences aren't the issue. The commonalities are the issue. So we have to look at those commonalities. And Marshall's book does not actually focus on that very much. In fact, he overlooks a lot of the parallels that I talked about in my book.
Okay. Well, we've set the discussion up nicely there. My guests on Unbelievable Today, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week here on Premier Christian Radio, they are David Marshall and Richard Carrier. David Marshall, author of a new book, Jesus Was No Myth, The Fingerprints of God on the Gospels, taking aim at people like Richard Carrier, my other guest on the show today, who says that Jesus never actually existed. And we'll be continuing this discussion in just a moment's time. If you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's show, then do go online and find us there. You can find the links to the social media where you can get in touch as well, from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links to past shows and more about my guests and where you can find their books. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Twitter is @unbelievablejb.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's come back to you then, David Marshall, as we start to open up this topic. I mean, a whole range of things that Richard explained there from his most recent book on the historicity of Jesus, reasons why he doesn't feel the historicity of Jesus adds up. He talked about the fact that the epistles that he thinks are not forgeries seem to take a sort of very spiritualized view of Jesus. The symbolic narratives that seem to be on display in the Gospels, which don't strike him as having a historical core. When it comes to the actual way they may have embellished or whatever, he says maybe they were borrowing from Old Testament figures. And then he obviously had some criticisms for your own book as well. Where do you want to begin with all this? There's a lot of material we could cover here.
Well, since it's a year of elections, let's begin with an elephant.
Okay.
C.S. Lewis compared critical scholars of his day, skeptical scholars of his day, to a blind man who couldn't see an elephant that was standing in front of him a few paces away. Well, in the old story of the elephant, there are several blind men, and they are feeling different parts of the elephant, and they don't see the totality of what the animal is. And I'm afraid Richard Carrier is a bit like all those blind men put together. He feels different parts of the Gospels, and he finds parallels, sometimes very fanciful parallels, to the Gospels and other pieces of literature all around the ancient world. But he doesn't manage to see the totality of what the Gospels are. Now, several years ago, we debated on a stage in Alabama, and I said that there are no ancient works, basically, that share the characteristics of the Gospels, that show them to be historical. And he brought up four parallels to the Gospels. He said, Tobit, the Golden Ass, Life of Romulus, and Apollonius of Tyana. He said these share all the characteristics of the Gospels. When I analyze those four works, I find that Tobit actually shares only three, and those are the weakest three, of the 30 characteristics that demonstrate that they're historical works. Plutarch, The Life of Romulus, shares up to four, solidly shares four of the characteristics, the 30 historical characteristics of the Gospels. The Golden Ass shares three again, and Apollonius shares four of the 30 characteristics, including the weakest characteristic, which is merely that they're both stories. So I don't think that Richard Carrier, despite his erudition, and I have to say that On the History of Jesus is very impressive in some ways because it has copious footnotes. He does a lot of work in with a lot of different bodies of literature. But ironically, I don't think he actually sees the totality of what the Gospels are. He sees little pieces here and there, and he finds parallels to other literature, sometimes very fanciful parallels. But he doesn't see the totality of what they are.
I mean, if we're talking about the Gospels, one of Richard's, criticisms is that he thinks that mainstream scholarship doesn't take seriously the miraculous elements of the Gospels, and that they're clearly some sort of narrative device on the part of the people who wrote them down. You know, for instance, let's take that example he gave of the withering of the fig tree. It's meant to be some sort of symbolic thing about Israel and so on. There was no fig tree that got withered by Jesus, though, says Richard. In fact, you know, there was no Jesus as far as he's concerned. So how do you respond to that kind of criticism?
Well, first of all, as I show in my Jesus Seminar book, many skeptical scholars who are less radical than Richard Carrier very directly say that, you know, we can't really believe these things in the modern era. We can't believe in miracles. Well, the problem is, as someone who has worked in the mission field, I've met many people who actually experienced miracles, have experienced the hand of God on their lives in dramatic ways. So it's very difficult for me to say, to go along with that prejudice against miracles in ancient works when I find that they're going on, and Craig Keener has shown that they are, in fact, occurring all around the world as we speak. God is working in supernatural ways to speak to people in some sometimes pretty incredible ways. So I can't agree with that bias against miracles, and I don't think it's very philosophical to assume that my worldview is the only one that's legitimate when we approach the New Testament.
And, well, let's just do one more thing then before I come back to Richard for his responses. And what about the view that Jesus sort of is being compiled kind of to reflect some of those Old Testament things? He's going to be the new Adam, the new Moses, the new Elijah, and so on. Obviously, we as Christians, we do draw parallels of the ways in which Jesus does become for us, you know, a new kind of savior figure in that sense. We just Christians believe it's he really existed and was and kind of drew together all those prophetic strands. But I guess Richard's point is, no, he didn't exist. They just made him up in order to draw together those kind of ancient sort of strands of Jewish thinking. What's your response to that, David?
Well, frankly, when I was reading certain parts of Richard's book, my immediate response was to say, hallelujah. I mean, there are many things that he brings up that I think are very interesting in that regard. Yes, from a Christian point of view, Jesus did fulfill in amazing detail and in amazing depth. The pattern is amazing. But I would add one more point to that. And as a scholar of East Asian religion, I find that Jesus also fulfills in a pretty amazing way some of the deepest yearnings as expressed in various cultural motifs and the New Year's celebration and the language of Chinese civilization as well. Even in the Tao Te Ching and in other ancient Chinese scriptures, I find things that fit Jesus better than anybody else. So you can't very well say that the New Testament, that the Gospels were made up in order to make Jesus fulfill these motifs in the ancient East Asia.
We'll come back to you, Richard, in a second, because we're just coming to the end of the first section, believe it or not, and we've hardly scratched the surface yet. But we'll make sure there's more of a back and forth, and we'll come back to you for your response to some of this in the next section. Joining me on Unbelievable today is David Marshall and Richard Carrier, talking about whether Jesus was a myth based on other legendary religious figures of his day. We'll be back in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Have you heard the one about the three comedians who walked into a church? In our New Year edition, meet Milton Jones, Sally Phillips and Paul Carenza as they have a conversation on putting together their faith with careers in TV and radio comedy. Plus, we talk to the Reverend Richard Coles, former 80s pop star, now one of the UK's most famous vicars. Sam Hales attends a New Age fair and tells you what happened. All that plus much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for open dialogue and debate. Not comfortable listening all the time, especially if you hear someone like Richard Carrier talking about why he doesn't believe Jesus ever actually existed. But we always try and bring on people who are well-matched in terms of dialoguing and debating these issues. And today on the programme, David Marshall joins me, author of a recent book, Jesus Was No Myth, the fingerprints of God on the Gospels. And they're going to be talking about whether Jesus was a myth based on other legendary religious figures of his day. And that's what David Marshall takes aim at in his latest book. If you want to get in touch with the programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the way to email in. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And links there as well on the website to our show, to the podcast. You can rate us on iTunes if you subscribe on the podcast. We always like it when people do that. And lots more links, resources and other things as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Let's jump back into this then. Richard Carrier, you're here as our mythicist on the programme today. And I know we're trying to cover a lot of bases here, but there were a number of different issues that David brought up in that last section. He says that when you had that debate in Alabama, you claimed that there were all of these kind of characteristics that the gospel shared with other mythical literature of the time, the Golden Ass, Plutarch's Romulus, Tobit, Apollonius and so on. He says when you actually go and look at it, very, very few of these supposed characteristics are actually shared by the gospels. He believes the gospels are pretty unique in that sense, in the way they portray Jesus. Accuses you of a naturalistic bias in, it's just the fact you don't believe in the supernatural that makes you dismiss the miracle passages in Scripture. And frankly, he says, of course, why wouldn't we see those similarities with the Old Testament? But I also see lots of ways in which Jesus fulfills many other religious yearnings around the world. And again, this is evidence of the uniqueness of Christ in ways that no other religious figures are. So, quite a bit to respond to there. Do you want to take those in order, Richard?
Yeah, all religious figures are unique in some sense, so that doesn't really argue for their historicity. So I'm not even going to address that one. The issue of miracles, I mean, no miracle claim has ever survived scientific inquiry. The fact that Marshall just believes stories told to him that haven't undergone proper scientific inquiry, that to me is indicative of being a Christian apologist and not actually being someone like a dispassionate, objective scholar on this issue. The fact of the matter is, when we look at stories in any other religion that have these kinds of wild, fabulous events, we immediately recognize that as myth. We don't try to defend them as actually having happened. And we can't treat Christianity differently. We can't give it some sort of bias that we're not applying to other texts like this. So when we see stories like that, the first and most obvious conclusion is that these are made-up stories. If you want to argue that they're not made-up stories, you're going to need much better evidence than we have. So that also, I don't think is, but that would be a whole separate debate on naturalism and ontology and metaphysics and the whole thing. But if we get to the core of the issue, which is historical analysis, literary analysis of the text, what he said about, for example, Tobit and the other books, he's confusing method with purpose. All novels, all myths have different purposes and different messages. So if you were to actually point to all of that and point out the differences, you could say, oh, no novels are like each other and no myths are like each other if you're just going to focus on the different messages they contain or the different purposes that they contain. That's not the issue. The issue of commonality is in method. They use common methods of communicating what they need. And the Gospels and these other texts, for example, what they do that are in common are that, for example, they don't name their sources. They don't criticize their sources. They don't compare sources and say, this is why I went with one source and not another. They contain fabulous events. They contain a storyline that leads to a climax. The storyline is built into the whole structure of the story from beginning to end. Their prose narratives presented as true. They promote religious beliefs, and they do so with a central hero. And they do it the same way as Mark does. They tell the stories as if nothing is made up, as if it's just true. That's very different, for example, from Plato's dialogue, which opened the title of Plato's dialogue is a fiction of. So Plato's actually saying this is fiction, but it's just useful fiction. These books don't do that. They present their stories as if they're true and unquestionable, uncritically, don't name sources, don't use the structure of rational history of the period. They use the structure of tales that are meant to convey religious beliefs and convey the purposes and meanings of the authors. And when you look at that, you look at all of, for example, nearly all of the criteria, nearly all the 30 criteria that Marshall lists in his book are not actually evidence of historicity. They're not criteria any historian would use to establish the historicity of a text. What they are is evidence of authorial intent. These are countercultural authors writing countercultural fiction. They're critical of their society, critical of elite literature, for example, critical of old ways of thinking. And so they're setting up models for missionaries to convey this countercultural message they have using the techniques that were available for anyone to do this through other myths and other religions who had other messages. When you look at countercultural movements, an example would be The Lives of Aesop, for example, which are that's also a countercultural literature. And I talk about that in On the History of Jesus. So all of this really looks like that. And when we look at the few criteria that actually relate to historicity, Marshall's book does not interact at all with the peer-reviewed literature on this. When I talk about, for example, the argument from embarrassment, the argument from dissimilarity, and so on, I actually cite and summarize leading peer-reviewed discussions of this by other scholars, and I actually give examples of what the problems are with these things. Marshall's book doesn't address that peer-reviewed literature, doesn't address their arguments, doesn't address my examples. And I think this actually makes his book not very useful for someone who wants to actually critically examine my book. The best you could do instead is just to read my book and then the peer-reviewed literature it's based on. Marshall's not really interacting with it.
Okay. So a few criticisms there, David. I don't know where you want to begin. I mean, perhaps the whole debate over naturalistic biases and that kind of thing is best shelved for the moment. For the moment, we can just agree that you agree to differ on whether we should, be prepared to accept miraculous explanations and so on in historical records. But I mean, there's a lot of criticism here from Richard there. He says really what we're looking at is common methods, and those are the things he notes the similarities of between the Gospels and other kind of records of the time of what he would see as made up events, you know, not naming the sources, fabulous events taking place, a storyline that reaches a climax, promotion of religious beliefs, telling the story as though it's evidently true, and so on. So do you want to just clarify exactly what you were trying to say about what these sort of 30 criteria, which you don't think, as Richard does, that the Gospels share with other kind of legendary literature of its day?
Well, frankly, I'm not sure that Richard has read my book even as well as read the Gospels. I explain why each one of those 30 characteristics is relevant to historicity in some detail. And as far as not being useful for a scholarly discussion, actually my books have always gotten good reviews from scholars, whereas Richard Carey's book on the historicity of Jesus has been panned by scholars. James McGrath at Butler University, for example, answers some of these very questions that Carrier brings up right now. And Carrier does not interact with what McGrath says at all. McGrath points out that these so-called traits of biographical writings were not necessarily true of Jewish biographical writings, like the Maccabees, for example. They didn't always name their sources. They didn't always care so much about doing that. And the parallel that I just brought up, the Analects of Confucius, is the same way. The Analects of Confucius also does not name its sources. It also does not name its authors. And those are kind of rather insignificant characteristics compared to the ones that I'm actually talking about in this book.
What are you talking about in the book, then? What are the characteristics you do want to bring out?
Well, the ones that I named earlier, the stylistic and literary qualities, undesigned coincidences. I could just name them. There's 30 of them. It's a little hard to go through each one of them in detail. For example, the teachings of Jesus. And I'm really amazed that anybody can compare the Gospels to Aesop's fables. That's just, let me put it this way. Dr. Carrier often recommends his readers to go back and look and read the literature that he's talking about. And I would make the same recommendation. When you actually read, for example, the Sophia of Jesus Christ, which Carrier also compares to the Gospels, it's basically empty prattling. It's inane material. It's really not interesting at all. I recommend that listeners actually read the works that Carrier compares to the Gospels, and I think you'll laugh. Apollonius of Tyana, I believe, was the original script for Saturday Night Live. It's hilarious if you actually go back and read it. There's no rational comparison between the texts that have been found and compared to the Gospels by critics like Richard Carrier and even Bart Ehrman.
David, Richard also levels this attack that your book simply doesn't interact with the peer-reviewed literature enough. It's not very scholarly, I think, is basically what he's saying. What's your response to that?
Yes. First of all, I think that my book has gotten better reviews from scholars so far than Richard's has. I've seen it panned quite a bit on by scholars online. But to address a specific point on criteria of embarrassment, it's true that I don't go into quite as much depth in looking at some of the background writings on that subject, because I find that Richard Carey himself uses the criteria of an embarrassment in an embarrassingly dissimilar way from how he says it should be used. He describes 11 tests that the criteria of embarrassment should pass, and he says it never passes it in relation to the Gospels. But then he himself uses what he calls the counter-biased corroboration, which is, to my way of thinking, is just another way of saying the criteria of embarrassment. And he never makes his own historical texts pass those 11 tests that he himself has set. Even on page 400 of On the Historicity of Jesus, Richard Carrier, on the top of the page, he says, you know, I've proven that the criteria of embarrassment is basically useless when it comes to the Gospels. But then in a footnote on the same page, he actually uses the criteria of embarrassment under a different name to discuss the historicity of the Gospels. So if he doesn't want to apply his own rule, then I don't know why anybody else should want to take that very strong. And I find that the criteria of embarrassment is, in fact, used in a much less rigorous way by other historians working in other fields anyway.
Okay, well, the gloves have come off a bit here. Richard says that your book itself didn't get terribly good reviews from the scholars, and accuses you of sort of double standards here in terms of this issue of the criterion of embarrassment and whether you're applying it consistently. Do you want to answer that and then any other further thoughts on the other issues that David answered when we came back from the break?
Yeah. In point of fact, my book hasn't been panned by any mainstream qualified scholar. It hasn't been reviewed in the peer-reviewed literature. There's only one scholar who actually has any relevant qualifications who's panned it, and that's James McGrath. He's not done so under peer review. He's not done so in the academic journals. He's only done it on his blog. And in fact, he extensively lies about the contents of my book. And I've actually documented his lies and how he's actually lying about the book. That's on my blog. So you can go to my blog and search the James McGrath name, and you can read all about the way that he is actually falsely representing what's in the book. So that's actually an extremely disingenuous remark to make. I think that's actually quite fallacious. I'm talking about the fact that you better interact with the peer-reviewed literature if you're going to actually make these kinds of claims, and David Marshall's book does not. He doesn't address any of the peer-reviewed literature on the argument, the criterion of embarrassment, as I did. I cite that literature extensively. I summarize it, and this is all in Proving History, my book, Proving History. I also, in Proving History, talk about when the criterion of embarrassment actually works and applies. I even give examples from the Gospels when it actually works and applies. It doesn't work and apply in a way that establishes the historicity of Jesus, but it does work and apply in other ways. And so his characterization of me as being inconsistent is simply false. If you actually look at the way I use the criteria, you'll see the consistency of it, and if you look in Proving History, you'll understand why and when these criteria apply. It doesn't work for the historicity of Jesus, because the things we need to know to establish any actual embarrassment that applies to this case doesn't fit. And I talk about that even in Proving History in the context of, for example, statements against interest in courts of law. The same criteria and problems apply, that they just don't apply to the Gospels, because the Gospels, we can't establish what their sources are, we can't establish who was reading them or when, we can't establish their dates, we can't establish what was even embarrassing, we can't establish, even if anyone argued against what was in the Gospels, because we don't get to hear any critics of the Gospels. None of that literature was preserved, if any of it was written. That's a few other reasons. There's lots of reasons why this criterion doesn't work, and this isn't coming from me. This is actually coming from peer-reviewed experts, qualified experts in the peer-reviewed literature who've written about this repeatedly in various ways. And so if you're going to deal with this kind of criterion, you need to build on and critique and interact with the actual peer-reviewed literature that where we are now at the state of the question in the field. David Marshall's book doesn't do that. That's one side of it. Let's go to the other aspect of this, which is, again, the criteria that David invents. They almost all relate to stylistic and literary qualities, and that's a direct quote. Even he says that, said that just now. But those criteria are not the criteria used by actual historians in any history field. They're not used by historians to establish a text as historical. Those are actually criteria, insofar as they're used at all. They're criteria for establishing authorial intent, the intentions of the author, in terms of what purpose or message they had, not necessarily with regard to whether the stories they're telling are actually true, but simply in regards to why they tell the story in that way rather than some other. And that doesn't really help us get through the historicity question. And that's why when you look at the peer-reviewed literature on the actual criteria used to get at historicity, they're very different kinds of criteria. And those criteria don't really work on the Gospels because of the nature of the text and the nature of the evidence that we have is different from other things we have, like, for example, the letters of Cicero, which are very different texts in many respects. And there are a lot of other things I find. David Marshall often does this where he says things that are generally false. I will stop short of calling him a liar on this, but let's just say, for whatever reason, he's made false statements.
What were you about to say then, David?
I said he has before. He might as well do it now.
Okay. but carry on, Richard. What were you about to say?
Yeah. So, for example, he says that there's no parallels between the Gospels and Aesop's fables. That has nothing to do with what I said. I'm talking about the lives of Aesop, which are the biographies, the bioi of Aesop. And I actually have an extensive section on the historicity of Jesus where I show point by point the parallels between the lives of Aesop and the Gospels of Jesus. So for Marshall to make that mistake suggests to me that he hasn't really carefully read my book. He isn't aware of the fact that I'm talking about the lives of Aesop. He isn't aware of the fact that there are extensive parallels that I document in there. And nowhere in Jesus is No Myth, nowhere in his book does he address those parallels. He doesn't talk about it. Another example is he brings up the Sophia of Jesus Christ. He doesn't tell you how I use that text. I actually don't use that text as a parallel for the Gospels in general. I use that text as an example of how Christians fabricated literature. I talk about that on the historicity of Jesus. It's at the top of chapter 10. So you can see there I'm using it in a very different way than David Marshall has just characterized.
Okay.
So I find that very I don't use Apollonius of Tyana anywhere on the historicity of Jesus. I don't use that as a parallel. So imputing that to me is also incorrect.
Okay, quite a few criticisms of you there from Richard Carrier. David, he says you misrepresent him in various ways. He doesn't use Apollonius. You've got the wrong end of the stick with his reference to Aesop, talking about Aesop's lives and so on. Also this big issue of, he says, what you're establishing is not the historicity of the Gospels, but rather the authorial intent of the Gospels, and that does not establish the historicity. So, yeah, do you want to respond to some of those?
Yeah, basically, I don't think Richard has had much time to read my book, so I'll give him a little bit of charity on that one. I don't think he's read carefully what I actually argue. It's certainly not true that most of the characteristics I discuss are stylistic or literary. Only 6 or 7 of them are out of 30, and those I explain why they're historically relevant. And Richard really hasn't interacted with any of those arguments. As for his use of the Sophia of Jesus Christ, I'll put that up on my blog. I've already have a transcript of our previous debate where he brings up Apollonius of Tyana, and that's really pretty normal. I mean, there are many, many skeptics who bring up Apollonius of Tyana as the closest parallel to Jesus because, frankly, they can't find anything any better. And I already mentioned several parallels that Richard brought up in our earlier debate, and dramatically how completely they fall short of a parallel to the Gospels of Jesus Christ. Now, Richard can say that the Gospels were borrowed from hither and yon from various sources, but he can't find any parallels to the Gospels. And frankly, it's pretty amazing because the Gospels of Jesus Christ have dramatically changed the world, and people around the world recognize their unique and powerful content. Jesus is a unique person. To give it a little bit of a personal story, let me put it this way. Several election cycles ago, there was a debate in the United States between vice presidential candidates Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle. And Dan Quayle made the point to try to portray himself as kind of a second coming of John F. Kennedy. And Lloyd Benson made the very cutting response, "Mr. Quayle, Senator Quayle, I knew John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was a friend of mine, and Senator Quayle, you are no John F. Kennedy." And frankly, I think that whether you are an experienced scholar or whether you are a first-time reader to the Gospels, almost everyone who reads the Gospels intuitively recognizes the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. They recognize that they're confronting someone unlike anyone else they've ever met before. And I think what I'm doing in this book is analyzing some of the traits that the fingerprints that we maybe can't perceive or recognize exactly what they mean, analyzing them historically, but intuitively, inchoately, I think that people generally recognize the uniqueness of Jesus. And so when they read some of the parallels that skeptics have scoured the ancient world for to find, the contrast is often shocking and sometimes rather hilarious.
There was this criticism, David, that you'd misconstrued what he meant by the Aesop. He was talking about Aesop's stories, not Aesop's life, not Aesop's fables. Do you remember coming across that in his work?
I remember it vaguely. He wrote 1,200 pages on the subject, and I may very well have misconstrued him on that point.
Okay. Why don't we move the conversation on, Richard, to talking about this issue of obviously for David, it is significant that Jesus is unique and doesn't share any parallels, these supposed parallels, or very few at least, of the ones that he says that you do make comparisons with other figures. What in particular would you say are the parallels of Jesus himself as a figure that you do strike between Jesus and other mythical figures of the day?
Yeah, it depends on which aspect you're talking about. Of course, we can talk about the parallels, which you already did mention, with Moses and Elijah. There are many of those. But if we're looking at figures outside that context, the whole model of Jesus has a lot of parallels with other deities that do similar things. And this is this actually ties back to the whole mystery religion aspect. And this is an example of what I've been talking about with regard to David Marshall's book. He has a section in there where he tries to argue that Christianity was not a mystery religion, contrary to the section I have in On the History of the City of Jesus, where I established that it was a Jewish version of the mystery religions of the time. He starts in there, but he asks where I got those ideas, even though in fact in the book I very plainly state and quote that this comes from the peer-reviewed expert literature on the mystery religions, particularly the work of Petra Pekkanen, which I plainly cite and summarize. And you won't learn that from his book, nor does he address her work. He gives the impression that I just made this stuff up, that I'm not getting it from the actual expert literature on mystery religions. But then he tries to argue that the four criteria that come from Pekkanen, and that I use to identify a mystery religion just as she does, and then he tries to critique those four criteria, and there's lots of specious critique going on there, but he ignores the other features I enumerate in the exact same section in the On the Historicity of Jesus. He never mentions a response to those criteria as if I never listed them. And that, to me, I find both dishonest, and I also find it's going to mislead or not be useful to readers who want a proper critique of what I actually argued. You actually have to actually critique it. You can't just ignore a huge swath of what the argument is. And the examples are, for instance, the role of baptism, including baptism for the dead, just as we see in Paul, the role of taught mysteries, the ritual sharing of sacred meals, the role of securing eternal life through a suffering savior, and a passion story, using the exact same word, passion, used in many mystery religions, the savior god that was worshipped undergoes some sort of suffering, has a passion, a passion story relating to that, and the demarcation of adults and children as ranks possessed of different levels of knowledge and things like this. But let's go back to that, the savior gods of these other cults. They all are the child of God. They're all either the son of God or the daughter of God. They all undergo some sort of suffering. Sometimes that suffering is an actual death. And then through that suffering, they gain victory over death. They gain the power over death that they can share with their followers that gives them eternal life in some sort of lovely paradise or whatever the particular religious version of it is in each particular case. And this is the narrative that comes over and over and over again we see in mystery religion, mystery religion, mystery religion. And then the Jesus story actually matches this, and it basically Judaizes it. It takes these the overlapping and similar ideas and then related ideas from Judaism, Old Testament and other sources, and then attaches them on and builds their own version of this suffering savior. So it's very much an amalgam of Jewish and pagan ideas, which means it's different from both the Jewish precedents and the pagan precedents because it's combining the two of them. And so when we look at that, we see many different parallels that are of these generic types, these elements of the Son of God who undergoes some sort of suffering, often that's a death and resurrection, and then is able through that to convey this power to their followers through baptism. And this is a thing that we see time and again.
Okay, so it's essentially a Judaized version of what were the common traits of mystery religions of that day and age, is what you're saying there. We'll come back to David for a response to that in the final part of today's programme. You're listening to Unbelievable, the show where Christians and non-Christians get together for dialogue and debate, listening to a scholarly, if sometimes somewhat rancorous argument today between my two guests. They are David Marshall and Richard Carrier, on both sides of the issue of whether Jesus was a myth or not. That's the view of Richard Carrier. Jesus was a myth, as expounded in his latest book on the historicity of Jesus. David Marshall's latest book is Jesus Was No Myth. I'll make sure there are links to both guests from today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Come back again in a few minutes' time and we'll hear the conclusion. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. And if you're listening this Saturday afternoon and you'd like to recommend the show to someone else, listen back, why not join the many people who podcast the programme, who reach it via the internet. All the links and much more available from today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I'll be making sure to post links, of course, to the Unbelievable Conference coming up on Saturday the 13th of May once the ticketing's available. And you can also, of course, respond to the latest show, recent shows, by joining in there with some of the discussions that happen underneath each edition of the programme. But we'll be hearing some of your feedback via email as well and Facebook a little later on in the programme today. Before we leap back into the final part of today's discussion, just a note that Michael Weir joins Sam Hales for the profile between 4 and 5 today. Michael Weir, the former faith advisor to Barack Obama. And if you're coming back for Unbelievable at the same time next week, got a discussion for you between theistic evolutionist Dennis Alexander and Wayne Rossiter, who's also got a background in biology. In fact, he converted from atheism. He, though, has significant criticisms for theistic evolution. And you'll be hearing their conversation on the programme at the same time next week. For the moment, let's get back into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So coming back to you, David Marshall, we heard there Richard Carrier in that last section making a number of claims about the way that the Gospels and Christianity share a lot of the traits of mystery religions. He accuses you actually not really engaging properly with the peer-reviewed literature in this area. But for the moment, at least, he gave a number of examples of the way in which it appears that the life of Jesus parallels other aspects of mystery religions. Often the hero at the centre is involved in a death and resurrection and passes on his power through a sort of baptism and so on. And all of these, he says, you know, kind of get worked into the Jesus and Christianity, yes, certainly with a Judaistic kind of filter to them, but at the end of the day we're looking at another mystery religion here. So what's your response to that? Why don't you agree with Richard Carrier on that front?
Well, I think Richard's argument is ad hoc. It's the number of criteria too few. They are peripheral. They're not really to the heart of what a mystery religion is. And all four of them, all the four characteristics that he lists are very problematic and, in fact, incorrect. He says that, for example, or else they're irrelevant. For example, he says that a mystery religion involves syncretism of local and national system of religious ideas with distinctly Hellenistic ideas. Well, every new religious faith, and even you could say Richard Carrier's book, is syncretistic in the sense that he defines syncretism in the same passage. When you read a work like Euripides' The Bacchae, a very short 7-line poem that I copy onto that part of my argument from The Bacchae contains 9 different qualities of a mystery religion that describe what mystery religions were really like. But Richard doesn't even bring up those more central qualities. He brings up these very peripheral qualities that, in fact, are not true in some cases. So I'm not very impressed by that argument, but it's kind of typical of Richard Carrier's arguments. He does the same thing with Acts. He finds 9 characteristics of the book of Acts, which are supposed to be typical of biography, or I don't remember which characteristic he was trying to compare the Acts of the Apostles to. And then he says, well, this must be an early novel, because this is what novels are like. Or the novel was the character, was the trait, the the category that he was trying to fit the Acts into. He said, Acts of the Apostle must just be another novel, because look at all these novels. This is just exactly what all these nine characteristics are the same characteristics that the novels ancient world had displayed. The problem is, as anybody who knows missions literature, you often find the same nine qualities in missions writings from people who actually live, and in some cases are my actual friends. My friend Don Richardson, who worked as a missionary in New Guinea, for example. All nine qualities that Richard Carrier lists as showing that a work must be a piece of ancient Greek novel writing also would prove that Peace Child by Don Richardson is a work of ancient Greek novel writing. So this is the kind of problem that I described in the beginning of the show. It's kind of a confirmation bias, cherry-picking approach to reading the Gospels. You find certain traits which you think are going to help the Gospels align with your particular category, and then you just kind of ignore the far more important traits which all the rest of the world sees but you. And I think that's really not just Richard Carrier's problem. It's an endemic problem with a lot of skeptical literature as it approaches the Gospels. It tends to see like the blind men looking at the elephant. They tend not to see the totality of the creature which they are confronting. Often very brilliantly. I mean, there's some very interesting insights in that analysis, but they're missing the big picture.
Are you missing the big picture, Richard?
No, not at all. On the Acts thing, I'm not going to deal with that here. We could do a whole show on why Acts looks like fiction.
It might be interesting to get you back on for that question, actually, Richard. I don't know if you're aware of Lydia McGrew, who was mentioned by David, but I understand she's got a book coming out on Acts and defending it. So maybe we could get you in conversation with her at some point. But that's for another show. But go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah, let's get to the other point. He's claiming that I'm identifying peripheral attributes of mystery religions. In fact, no, I am identifying central attributes that are definitive, that actually define the mystery religions as what they are. And I'm doing this based on the peer-reviewed expert literature. I'm relying on what experts have actually said mystery religions are. I'm using the core criteria that they use. So for him to mischaracterize that as peripheral issues is both disingenuous and another example of how he's just completely dismissing and disregarding peer-reviewed experts on these issues. I mean, if you're going to deal with these kinds of questions, you have to actually deal with what the mainstream expert literature is saying about them. And you can't just like dismiss stuff by saying, oh, those are just peripheral criteria. No, those are central criteria. These are the criteria that make a mystery religion what it is. And when we find all these criteria, when there's a lot of them, we find all of them, they're very peculiar, especially the conjunction of them all is very peculiar. And we find them again and again and again and again all over the Mediterranean. And then we find suddenly the Jews have one, and they produce one that has all the same criteria. That's not coincidence. They didn't just randomly, accidentally invent a new version of their religion that exactly matches all these peculiar criteria of the mystery religions exactly in conjunction. No, that's not how historians explain the evidence like this. When they see evidence like that, it's cultural diffusion. That's the most likely hypothesis to explain how this happened, far more likely than random accidents or divine intervention. And so if people want to analyze this, they want to look at the evidence of this, they want to look at the literature on this and see what experts have actually said and how I use the expert literature, they've got to read my book on the historicity of Jesus. They're not going to learn any of this stuff from David Marshall's book. He doesn't even address it. He ignores most of it.
David, do you want to defend yourself again?
Oh, that's total nonsense, Richard. You've been making accusations against both Christian and non-Christian scholars. You call Christian scholars, non-Christian scholars, liars, delusional, crazy at times. This is your typical MO. I'd frankly feel a little bit left out if you didn't play the same game on me as well. What I do is I analyze those four characteristics, which you describe as typical of mystery religions, and I show that none of them are both pertinent and apply to the Gospels. In fact, most of them are just plain mistaken. And even if those four very vague criteria did meet the Gospels, did describe the Gospels, that's too few, and they're not really very central. You don't even talk about the character of a mystery religion should be mysterious, or that it should be hidden in some way, or this should be a secret in some way. I think your analysis is frankly not very convincing, and I don't think anybody has been convinced by it, and thus they haven't actually read the original documents.
We're going to have to start to draw things to a close now. I mean, one question I have for you, Richard Carrier, first of all, maybe, is if you are correct and the Gospels do share all these characteristics with religions that we don't take to be true, does that by definition kind of exclude their historicity? Or, you know, is it possible that it could be true even if it does share characteristics with other religions of its day?
Oh, absolutely. And I even make that point explicitly in On the Historicity of Jesus. In fact, I don't downscore the probability of historicity based on the fact that Christianity is a mystery religion. It could well be a mystery religion based on a historical figure. The relevance of that parallel is when you start looking at the construction of the literature and the construction of the religion, it actually makes more other explanations more likely than they would otherwise be. And I analyze that and show how that worked out in On the Historicity of Jesus. But I want to point out that I do extensively talk about mysteries and secrets and secret doctrines as an element of mystery religions. It's in there as one of the criteria when I talk about mystery religions. I extensively document that there were secret teachings within Christianity. So for David Marshall to say that I didn't address that is an example of this complete dishonesty about what I actually argue, and the fact that his book completely ignores that criterion and all the other criteria. He says these four criteria he picks are peripheral. No, they're not even the only criteria I list. They're four of a number of criteria, and he ignores the other ones. And all those criteria, including those four criteria that he's dismissing, come from the expert peer-reviewed literature. And so that's really the difference that we're looking at here. I'm doing scholarship. He's doing Christian apologetics. And I'll tell you, this is not something you have to take my word on. This is something that people can independently, empirically verify. All you have to do is go read my treatment of this subject, go read his treatment of the subject. Any person who's not a dead-set fundamentalist Christian apologist will see the difference and will actually understand that what I'm saying is a correct account of this conversation here and that what he is saying is not.
Okay. Well, I will leave it to people to go and make their own minds upon that. David, I mean, one question that has occurred to me in everything that's been said here is I remember C.S. Lewis, who was very acquainted with ancient mythology and that kind of thing. And one of the things that held him back initially during his conversion period was that he wondered, was Christianity just another dying and rising kind of God religion that he saw so many of? And I think it was a conversation with his friend J.R.R. Tolkien, who said, what if Christianity is the true myth in that sense, the one that all other myths are pointing to and find their fulfillment in this one. In that sense, it feels like, you know, in that story, Lewis was willing to see the way that Christianity did have similarities with other religions in the way that it told its story and so on. But he was willing to say, actually, this is the one that is true. This is the one that all of those others, if you like, are pointing towards. Now, are you saying there are no similarities between Christianity? It is completely unique compared to any other religion or any of the surrounding religions of its time. Or are you prepared to say, yes, there are. It does share some commonalities. And like Lewis, we can see that this has been somehow fulfilled in Jesus. Where do you kind of fall on that kind of stuff?
Well, I think you probably know already, Justin. I'm critiquing a specific argument that Richard Carrier makes in his book in that passage. But of course, I do believe, and in my own set of criteria, of the 30 characteristics that I described the Gospels, demonstrating the historicity of the Gospels, there's only one that has to do with what I call fulfillment. And that is one of two what I call theological characteristics. And that's kind of the central message of the Gospels, which if you would expect that the evangelists to be focusing on, and they wouldn't really be focusing so much on these other characteristics, and which is why they're so significant historically. Yes, I believe that the Gospel is the fulfillment of Old Testament types and motifs and heroes, and I also believe that the Gospel is the fulfillment of truth in many other faiths and in many other religions, and I think that's one reason why the final chapter in my book is so significant, because I argue that not only does the Gospel fulfill myths and types within the Jewish culture and even within the Greco-Roman world, but also in the Norse world, in the Indian world, and in the Chinese world. And there's no credible line of causation or influence by which you could say that the authors of the Gospel had been reading, for example, the Book of Rites or the Book of History in ancient China, and that's where they got some of these ideas from. So Yes, I believe that fulfillment is very important for the gospel, and I believe that the gospel, Jesus comes as a fulfillment of mythological types and mythological themes around the world. And God knows what's in people's hearts. It would be a shocker, as C.S. Lewis recognized when he had that conversation with J.R.R. Tolkien, it would be a shocker if Christianity had absolutely nothing to do and no relationship with what people had been seeking for thousands of years. And G.K. Chesterton makes the same point. It would be, why would one want to believe a religion that had nothing to do with what people were seeking for in their hearts? And so, yes, I believe the gospel does fulfill myth and dreams and visions from around the world, but these historical criteria, which I described 30 of, show that it is not just a myth, but it is a myth that has come true.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, David Marshall and Richard Carrier, for being my guests on the show today. Time to give you ways to find out more about them both. RichardCarrier.info if you want to find out more about Richard. And you can find out more about David at christthetau.blogspot.co.uk. And both links to my guests and their books from today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thank you both again for being on the program with me. And I hope that you've enjoyed today's show. It was certainly a large measure of disagreement on the program today, but I'd be very interested in your responses as well. I'll give you the ways to get in touch in just a moment's time as we head on to hearing some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. You're listening to Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, that did get awkward in parts, didn't it? Let's be honest. And if you want to get in touch about what you heard today, perhaps you've got a take on the conversation, the way it was carried out, and some of the content within it, do feel free to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also, of course, leave me feedback via the Facebook and Twitter accounts at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter. Leave your thoughts that way or just get in touch and tell me what you're up to. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, where you can follow the show and various other articles that I post throughout the week that you may be interested in. I'm going to read out some feedback that's come in recently to some of those recent shows, including actually going back a bit, the discussion that Richard Carrier, who was with us today, had on Hitler and whether his sort of regime was inspired by Christianity, whether he could call himself a Christian even. That was in conversation with Richard Weikart, and we'll be seeing some of what you had to say about that. Just a quick mention before we get to some of that feedback, that Ed Atkinson, who is one of the people who chairs the Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group, wants to let us know that the next one happens on the 13th of February at 7:30 p.m. A new venue, Summers Town Coffee House, 60 Chalton Street, near King's Cross in London. Despite the name, it is actually a normal pub. They're going to be doing what they do, try and do every month, which is have a speaker and then have a discussion time with both Christians and skeptics engaging with one another. So if you can make it there, that's the 13th of February at 7:30. Heather Tomlinson this time will be speaking on Are Human Beings Fundamentally Good? Ed says, I'm excited about this, and I imagine the non-Christians having a more heated discussion between themselves than with the Christians. So more details as ever at the meetup.com website. Just search for the Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group on meetup.com. Thanks to Michael A. Leonetti, who got in touch to say he started listening to the programme recently. He's from Long Island in New York. Just wanted to write thank you for doing the show. Heard you first on the Eric Metaxas show and quickly got hooked. You're one of the three podcasts that I have time to listen to. Your show is transforming the way in which I think about engaging with people of different beliefs. I owe a great deal of thanks to you. Also, my best friend Ryan had recently out of the blue recommended your show to me as something he really likes. He didn't know I was listening to it for quite some time before he recommended it. I'd like to use your concept of hosting and engaging people on your show in a more local setting in the church. I like the way you mediate and host. Also, I'd be interested to hear in more detail about how you came on this journey to have debates like this. I'm not sure if you've covered it publicly anywhere. If you're ever about in my neighbourhood and you can suffer meeting a random stranger or two, let me know. I'm very close to Manhattan. My wife is half English, so I'm sure that gives me some credibility, although I'm sure you're very busy. No worries either way. Michael, lovely to get that email from you. Well, I was obviously in New York when I was on the Eric Metaxas show. That's where it broadcast from. But no immediate plans to return. So, but if you're ever in my neck of the woods, feel free to get in touch. Who knows? But in any case, as far as how I came into the whole story of hosting Unbelievable and, you know, doing it for over 10 years now. Something I actually cover in some detail in the book that I've been working on and which will be released in around May time. So if you fancy reading about it, you'll be able to do it there. I have told the story once or twice in shows over the years as well. So as you make your way through the back catalogue, you might hear me mention it there as well. Tom gets in touch to say, I fairly recently watched your video entitled How a Dice Can Show That God Exists. I really wanted to respond, but couldn't articulate my ideas clearly enough. This gentleman has, though, and you put me onto a link to a Cosmic Skeptic. He's a young atheist YouTuber who has done a response video to my dice video. This is basically a video making the case for the fine tuning of the universe and God. Which I've watched, and it's very impressive, good, interesting response to the video. I disagree, obviously, with much of what he has to say, but I have asked Cosmic Skeptic if he'd like to come on the programme to talk about it at some point. So we'll see if we can set something up in due course. Tony in Boise says, my goodness, the discussion about Hitler being a Christian is ridiculous. OK, so we're on to the Hitler, was he a Christian debate of several weeks ago now. Anyone can call themselves a Christian. That doesn't mean they are one. That's like saying someone who truly believes they're George Washington must be because he powders his hair, has false teeth, is 6'2", a fine horseman, and lives in Virginia. Sorry for the American analogy. The Bible's clear about what a Christian looks like, and it isn't Hitler. Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, which is to love people, including our enemies, not murder them. Thank you, Tony. This one is also from David Robertson, a regular show contributor over the years, who had to email in about that particular programme. What a fascinating show on Hitler with the two Richards. This is an area I've been interested in for the past 30 years. Richard Weikart was superb, certainly knew what he was talking about. Richard Carrier, a real disappointment. His definition of a Christian was so broad that it would include the devil. The trouble is that he's demanding that people prove a negative. If he's making the claim that Hitler is a Christian, he needs to show that Hitler actually followed Christ. If your definition of a Christian is someone who doesn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, doesn't believe he rose from the dead, doesn't believe he's coming again to judge the world, or that the Bible is the word of God, doesn't attend church, then yeah, I guess Hitler is a Christian. But then so is Richard Dawkins and Richard Carrier. Okay, thank you very much, David. And another one on this. Paul said, I was listening to the show on Hitler's religion. I read a bit on this topic, most notably Hitler's Cross by Erwin Lutzer, and of course have heard both atheists and Christians charge that he was everything from a Christian to a Darwinist to a Nietzschean atheist. The conclusion I've reached is that Hitler was simply insane, so his religion or worldview doesn't really enter into it. I think a far more fruitful line of discussion is to focus on the social, philosophical and religious forces that enabled someone like Hitler to come to power and lead a nation to commit such heinous atrocities. Living in an increasingly polarised USA right now, I think these are important discussions to be had. In any case, keep up the excellent work. The world needs more spaces like Unbelievable for thoughtful debate and meaningful conversation. Any chance you're developing an American or Canadian protégé? I'm about to exhaust the back catalogue and I'll need something to fill the void between your weekly shows. Thanks. Thank you very much, Paul. No, I'm afraid no American or Canadian protege in the pipeline, unless you're offering yourself in some way, Paul. Yes, no protege at all, really. But in any case, there's still plenty of life in me, Paul. I'm not going anywhere for the moment, but thanks for emailing in. Atheist Churchgoer, that was the show of a couple of weeks ago, and such a lot of response to this. This was Tom Hallam and Joe Ogborn. Joe is the Christian, Tom is the atheist, but they both go to church together most weeks. And it was just a fascinating sit down to talk about what that means practically, what stopped Tom from believing, how it's affected Joe's faith as well, bringing his atheist friend along to church so often, but, you know, it never having sort of persuaded him to change his mind and so on. Okay, so this was a fascinating email from Russell, who's given me permission to read it out. In fact, Russell got in touch via Facebook with me. So, Justin, I really enjoyed listening to the show titled My Friend the Atheist Churchgoer. I'm an atheist who's been going to church for the last 7 years. My wife and her family are Christians, and in the very beginning of our relationship, I reluctantly went along because I knew her faith was very important to her. I went infrequently and hesitantly at first, but over time, I was made to feel welcome as a member of the church to the point where I now I'll really enjoy going along to see the family of people I've seen on a weekly basis over the years. Believe it or not, I now play keyboard in the worship band, help organise events as part of the social team, and go along to a fortnightly small group with my wife. On the face of it, this seems great, but the sobering reality is that for years I've struggled to find a belief in the Christian faith. I've not encountered God in the way everyone else seems to, and I can't seem to read the Bible and study the evidence in order to realise that it's all true. Like Tom, I feel quite frustrated when I hear people say, "I sat at the back of church and the music started and I felt something" stories. I too really feel like I've tried. I have done the Alpha Course. I have prayed the Doubter's Prayer and been prayed for by others. I've studied the Bible. I've delved into C.S. Lewis. I've gone to Christian festivals and events. I listen to your podcast frequently. Nothing seems to have any impact on me. I don't have a whole list of arguments against the resurrection and the other key Christian beliefs. I just really don't feel in my heart that it's true. I question if anyone can really choose what they believe in. For now, I'll keep exploring the faith, enjoying the church, and eventually find out, I hope, if those that seek really do find God. All things considered, your podcast is great, and I will continue to listen and enjoy it. Russell, thank you. It's such an honest email, and I feel so torn reading your message there, because you've done everything, it seems, within your power to reach out to God and say, "I'm here. If it's true, just do something in me," you know. And I honestly don't know what the answer is for someone in your position, Russell. All I can commend you for is that you've been so willing to support your wife in her faith, and to the extent of obviously getting so involved in the church. And perhaps it's not more evidence that's needed. Perhaps something else is you know, a revelation. I think you mentioned in another message to me that the pastor of your church had talked about the fact you need a revelation more than information at this point. And who knows? But I hope this doesn't sound patronising in any way, Russell, but I will be praying for you, as I pray for many people who get in contact with me through the show. And lovely to hear from you in any case. Atheists come in all shapes and sizes, and there are many who are very open, it would appear, to the claims of Christianity, whereas others perhaps seem very closed off. And if I've learned anything in doing this show for over 10 years, it's that you can't pigeonhole people, and there really are all kinds of different people on atheists, but atheists of very different kinds. In any case, lovely to have you with me for this week. I hope you can come back at the same time next week for a discussion, this time between two Christians. You're unbelievable. Because I'll be sitting down with Dennis Alexander, one of the leading voices in theistic evolution here in the UK, and Wayne Rossiter, who's from the US. He was converted from atheism to Christianity, has a background in biology, but has some serious issues with Christians adopting theistic evolution. He was certainly convinced of evolution at one time in his life, no longer so for a variety of reasons. We'll be finding out why and about his book, In the Shadow of Oz. Look forward to seeing you again at the same time next week. Coming up next, The Profile.